Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Up, down, and all over the place go the markets. There's a word for that, you know. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's the 10th of August today, Wednesday. Kinda hard to believe the week's only half over, huh? Anyway, good to have you with us. And I'll tell you, we are obliged on what feels like the umpteenth day of 400 or 500 or 600-point swings in the Dow Jones Industrial Average to begin with some vocabulary. Here you go.
Volatility.
One more time, in case you missed it. It was quick.
Volatility.
A tendency to vary often or widely, as in price. Unpredictability, if you will. Today's fingers of blame for the market swings point to the French banking sector, but really, whatever the cause, the stomach-churning ride on Wall Street of late is starting to become a worry in and of itself. Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
Everyone can hear the screaming from this Wall Street roller coaster, and investment manager Hugh Johnson says to some degree, the real economy is taking a back seat to all the noise.
Right now, quite frankly, the level of volatility makes investors take their mind off important fundamentals and think about just preserving their capital. So it's not, in my judgment, this level of volatility is certainly not a good thing.
Consider this. Transfers in 401k accounts monitored by the tracking firm Aon Hewitt were four times the normal amount on Monday. In excess of $1.6 billion moved out of stock funds and invested primarily in bonds. That's a worrisome sign for Wall Street historian Charles Geist, a professor at Manhattan College. He fears investment capital to grow existing businesses and start new ones could dry up the way it did during the Great Depression, preventing the hiring of new workers.
I think that if investors are too badly scared by this, maybe to the point where some of them are starting to rethink their investment strategies entirely, that lack of capital investment will only become more of a self-fulfilling prophecy. No one will buy these new issues. The capital won't be raised. Employment won't be created.
Indeed, so far, nine companies have either scaled back or postponed plans for initial public stock offerings this week because of all the uncertainty. So what can be done to calm these troubled waters? Frank Fantozzi is a wealth manager at Plan Financial Services.
When you don't have faith in your leadership, it's tough to feel good about everything else.
In fact, all the market experts I spoke to today led off with that same answer. This fear will continue until investors start having faith that the federal government is serious about tackling our economic problems. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Well, along those lines, raise your hand if the first thing you thought of last week when the Dow dropped 512 points was 2008. September, October-ish, to be a little more precise. Yeah, same thing here. So in our search for reassurance that what's past is not necessarily prologue, we dialed up our New York bureau chief, Heidi Moore. Hey, Heidi.
Hey, Kai.
So I'm hoping you have the answer to this one. I need to know how this is different from 2008, because frankly, that's what a lot of people are thinking about.
Right. Well, I think probably public officials are taking less medication. 2008 was pretty hard for them. But in the actual answer is that we've been through 2008. You're a Navy man, right? So
yeah.
You know how it is. When you're training, you get stronger. So we've been through 2008, and we know what that looks like. And I'm not saying we're Navy SEALs, but we're certainly in a better position in terms of the banking system. You can look at the banks. They are better capitalized. They are watched like hawks right now, not just by the government, but also by the public. And also, the crisis that we're facing now is not a financial crisis within the banking system. It is an economic malaise.
Well, that gets me to my next question, which is I'm really, really happy that the banks are doing well. But talk to me about those of us who are not in the banking sector. I mean, what about the rest of the real economy?
Yeah, we have a divided economy, and even the experts don't know how to explain this. We have companies with huge corporate profits. The banks have been largely profitable, although it's been a rough year for them. And yet the rest of the economy is not doing well. Food stamps are on the rise. People are living off of credit cards. And of course, that thorny unemployment problem, which is the core of all of our problems. If we get employment going in some way, then we'll have a better economy and everyone will benefit. But until then, we're fairly insecure. And so I talked to Michael Holland, he's a fund manager, about whether the banks could be engulfed by this just general bad sense in the air that we've had lately. Here's what he said.
Fear and panic are self-perpetuating, so anything is possible. I think that bank crises are certainly within the purview of a lot of people right now.
And the problem with that is that unlike in 2008, now banks and the government are married, which means that the whole society is married to both banks and the government.
Interesting you use that word, society, because here comes the last question about banks and their impact on us. The French bank Société Générale today, right? All kinds of rumors that it was in serious trouble. They turned out not to be worth anything, but shares of that bank lost 15%. The entire financial sector in the United States was dragged down in the markets today. You're still going to tell me that the banks are doing fine and they're not going to lead us back into the morass?
Well, it's not the bank's fault that there's a rumor. I mean, what we saw in 08 was the same kind of rumors, and they're the ones that took down Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers. The truth is, you can never be strong enough as a bank or a government to avoid the effect of fear and panic. And that's what Michael Holland was saying. Mm-hmm. All you really need to destroy even the strongest bank is a rumor. And so if somebody wants to do that, it really can create an enormous problem for the rest of us.
So let's cut to the chase then. We're not in 2008. I get that part. Could we be?
We could be if the world economy is as bad as it's been and people get primed for panics and rumors. And that's what could take us down. But we've been working on the fundamentals of the economy and we'll be doing that for 15 more years at least.
Heidi Moore in our New York City Bureau. Heidi, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
On Wall Street today, do we really have to? Details, numbers, but only because they make me. We know a little bit more today about how the next round of the budget fight is going to shape up. The GOP has named its members of the supercommittee that's supposed to agree on $1 trillion plus in federal budget cuts. Commentator Robert Rice says the problem isn't just a failure to compromise. It's that failure takes our eye way off the ball.
We're slouching toward a double dip because we're getting the problem wrong. We're not in a debt crisis. Our current crisis is jobs, wages, and growth. The economy is at a standstill, with almost no growth in the first half of the year. A smaller percent of adult Americans is now working full-time than in almost three decades. The Fed cannot boost the economy by itself. Its near-zero interest rates haven't worked to date, and there's no reason to suppose they'll work any better in the future. We also need an expansive fiscal policy. Yet last week's budget deal makes it politically harder to enact the stimulus we need. There's a huge gap between what increasingly scared consumers are willing to spend and what the economy could produce at or near full employment. Republicans continue to claim the original stimulus didn't work. But revised data show the economy plunged 8.9% in the fourth quarter of 2008, the steepest quarterly decline in more than half a century. And in 2009, household buying contracted more than it has in almost 60 years. So this original stimulus was way too small to offset this. With cash-starved state and local governments simultaneously scaling back their own spending, the stimulus needed to be even bigger. The only hope now is voters will tell their members of Congress, who are on recess back home, to enact a bold jobs plan to jumpstart the economy. The government can now borrow money more cheaply than ever and use it for our roads, bridges, ports, parks, schools, and everything else that's being neglected, including more than 20 million Americans who want and need work.
Robert Reich was Secretary of Labor for President Clinton. His most recent book is called Aftershock, The Next Economy and America's Future. Next week in this space, David Frum is back. In the meanwhile, send us your thoughts. Marketplace.org. Click on the link that says Contact. You know who doesn't have to worry about a double-dip recession? United States Postal Service, that's who. Not because it's recession-proof. Quite the contrary, the post office still hasn't come out of its first dip. It's been financially troubled for a long time now. And this year, it's expected to be $9 billion in the red. So the USPS says it's going to close upwards of 3,700 post offices. Some of them will be replaced with village post offices, outlets kind of, inside an existing grocery store or other nearby retailer. The first village PO, as they're called, is opening today in a tiny town up in Washington State. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins went to check it out.
Town might be a tad grandiose for Malone, Washington. It's just six blocks of houses nestled in forest and farmland about 50 miles from the coast. Cheryl Lee didn't even know it existed until...
One day, my husband came home and said, "Honey, we're opening a store in Malone." And I said, "Where in the heck is Malone?"
Actually, it was 30 miles from her house. The store, Red's Hoppin' Market, is Malone's one-stop shop for coffee, cigarettes, beer, socks, and...
pickle sausages. People really like them. There's a Hot Mama, which is a spicier version, and a Big Daddy, which is a less spicier version.
Today, Red's becomes Malone's new village post office, replacing the old one across the street that was run by the Postal Service. Red's will sell stamps and flat-rate packages and rent mailboxes. Dean Granholm is the vice president of U.S. Post Office Operations.
I think Malone was costing us about $85,000 to $90,000 a year and was bringing in less than $20,000 a year.
He says by putting a scaled-down version of the post office inside a store, it'll be much cheaper to operate. And there's a much bigger post office a few miles away to handle home delivery and complicated shipments. I ran into Malone resident Darlene Ganey there. She was picking up 75 white and brown chicks. I asked her what she thought about losing Malone's post office.
I was amazed that they kept it open for so long because it is such a small post office.
The Postal Service will pay Red's Hoppin' Market about $2,000 a year to become the new village post. Red's may also cash in on increased sales from customers who stop in to send a package and leave with a gallon of milk. Dean Granholm says that makes the village post office a hot contract.
We do have some towns that have several stores that are really interested in the village post office concept.
Right now, the village post office enclosures may only save about $200 million a year, a sliver of the Postal Service shortfall.
It's not, a drastic change. It is a marginal change.
Public policy professor Lee Fritschler of George Mason University says if the village post concept catches on, it could replace thousands of money-losing post offices.
If I could do my mail business while I was shopping for my Cheerios and Wheaties at the local supermarket, I think I would view that as a real convenience.
And in many towns, the village post will be a return to the old ways. Nancy Graves fills in for Malone's postmaster on Saturdays. She'd probably be the mayor if they had one. She's the secretary treasurer of the water system and unofficial town historian. She shows me a picture from 1912.
When they brought the post office to Malone, they put it in the store.
That was fine 100 years ago, but some people in town aren't so comfortable with it now.
A lot of people are worried about the security because people still get their checks through the mail.
Still, if the choice is village post office or no post office...
Oh, I definitely wouldn't want to lose post office, period. I mean, you know, would we even be a place?
For now, Malone will still be a place with its own zip code, 98559. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Coming up,
geniuses are recession-proof, and geniuses make technology and innovate. I would think that is our dead sailing plan.
Will.i.am from the Black Eyed Peas. Technology, he is. But first, let's do the numbers. Alors, Wall Street took a big hit en français today. Troubles at the French bank Société Générale helped push down the Dow Jones Industrial Average 4.75%, 519 points landed with a resounding thud at 10,719. The Nasdaq said au revoir to 4%, 101 points, ended at 2381. The S&P 500 bid adieu to 4.4%, 51 points, exited at 1120, and I promise no more French. American banks felt Europe's financial pain. Bank of America threw off nearly 11% today. Citigroup parted with 10.5%. Gold bugs got another bump. The glitter rose to nearly $1,800 an ounce.
And hey, how about that downgrade? Bond prices rose again. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.09%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on international trade for June. Football is back. NFL preseason games begin. And the 111th National Hobo Convention gets underway in Britt, Iowa. Events include parades, music, and a memorial service. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Oil prices rose slightly today. Still, though, crude's down near six-month lows after a wild couple of days, which brings us once again to the word of the day, volatility. Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports that just like in stocks, ups and downs in the energy markets are no good either.
It's enough to make you dizzy if you watch too closely. Michael Levy is an energy expert at the Council on Foreign Relations.
Volatility is a fact of the markets. Big price swings are a fact of the markets. We've gotten used to relatively stable oil markets. That's been a treat.
But Levy says those treats are behind us.
It turns out that the natural state of oil markets is for prices to go way up and come way down.
Levy says the volatility in the oil markets freaks out consumers who don't know if they should buy a Prius or an SUV, and so don't buy anything. And it makes oil companies queasy. Analyst Phil Weiss from Argus Research says many new drilling projects are expensive and require high-priced oil to be profitable.
The one to come to mind first for me would be the oil sands and the deep water projects.
Low-priced oil is also bad for renewable substitutes like biofuels. Similarly, dips in the price of natural gas make solar and wind projects less attractive to investors. But Ethan Zindler at Bloomberg New Energy Finance says the swings in the market could end up helping renewables in the long run.
Volatility has a cost.
Firms pay that cost when they insure against market volatility.
Will this trigger people to reconsider the wisdom of a situation in which our energy security is based on a fickle commodity like oil or natural gas?
But he admits it's an easier argument to make when prices are on the high side of the bounce. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
It's Wednesday. We've got mail.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
We got all kinds of letters about my conversation Monday with David Beers from Standard & Poor's, about the downgrade, of course. You recall that S&P and the rest of the raters gave mortgage-backed securities AAA ratings until those securities helped tank the market and bring us the great financial crisis of 2008. Kerry Bouchard of Fort Worth, Texas, had this to say. Standard & Poor's, he wrote? It's like somebody hired a Donner Party survivor to run a wilderness guide accreditation agency. Commentator Rehan Salam put forward a modest proposal last week. Get the economy going by offering tax breaks to college graduates under the age of 25. Krista Froling of St. Louis said it's about time young people are given a helping hand.
Everyone is concerned with cutting Social Security and Medicare for the current generation. My generation has given up all hope that those benefits will even be around for us at all.
Lucretia Kolba from Nashville, Tennessee felt differently.
It's really frustrating to hear these college graduates whine and complain, oh, I can't find a job because the economy is bad. And I'm sitting here going, I could find a job when the economy was good.
Finally, we've been playing the sad music a lot the past week or so. So much, in fact, that I opined one day we should have something even sadder than the wah-wah trombones. And so, herewith, a medley of your suggestions. That last one, by the way, March to the Scaffolds from Symphonie Fantastique by Berlioz. You can send us your thoughts, music suggestions, whatever you like. Go to marketplace.org, click on the link that says contact.
Now for a little change of musical pace. You may know will.i.am, assuming you know him at all, as the frontman for the Black Eyed Peas. You probably don't know he's now the director of creative innovation at Intel and that he's leading a push for better science and technology education in schools. That's why he's teamed up with Dean Kamen, the guy who invented the Segway scooter, and Kamen's foundation called FIRST, or For Inspiration and Recognition of Science and Technology. They've gotten together to produce a television special called I Am FIRST, Science and Rock and Roll, about robotics championships for kids, grades K through 12. It airs on ABC this Sunday. Will I Am is here with us right now. Thanks a lot for coming in.
Hey, good to be here.
Tell me about this FIRST Foundation and Dean Kamen. How'd you get involved?
I was on my Segway, and I was thinking about all the innovation and imagination it took to create that. And so I called a friend, Ron Conway, like, yo, do you know who invented this? He was like, a good friend of mine, Dean Kamen. I was like, you know this guy? Can you introduce me to him? So he introduced me to him via email. And that's when he told me about US FIRST. He was like, you know, I got this program that I've been doing for 20 years, teaching kids science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. And we have robotics competitions every year. I was like, how come I never heard of that? He was like, that's the problem. I was like, well, if you have a robotics competition every year, we're performing at the Super Bowl. Maybe we could perform at your, make a halftime show at your robotics competition.
Did he understand what he was getting with the Black Eyed Peas? And
he thought maybe like I was going to show up and sing a song for the kids. So I called him 2 days later. I'm like, you know, Dean, I was thinking if you want people to know about this, I just performing for the choir ain't good. That ain't going to do nothing. Maybe you get a couple of tweets. I was like, you got to let me turn this into a TV show.
All right. So hang on, back up for just a second. You went to ABC
and I bought,
and bought the airtime.
But these kids, right? I'm like, if this little 13-year-old is building robots and writing code, I could at least go and buy some time on ABC to make a TV show out of it.
Tell me about these kids.
You know when you watch the movie Waiting for Superman, you're like, oh, man, America.
It's the documentary on education.
Oh, man. It's like, oh, we're so doomed. And your heart breaks. This is the total opposite of that. Here, you would think, like, somebody sprayed magic dust and out pops genius little kids.
Yeah, but it's interesting because there's a clip where we're going to roll this clip in now. It's a kid who was in a gang who got his girlfriend pregnant and he didn't know what to do. And then this robotics competition. And
changed his life.
And I saw what they did. And I got more interested into programming with Lewis. Seeing all of this and robotics, and it's really inspiring. I want to see myself doing something like that.
And he wants to build prosthetic hearts.
Yeah.
How do you amplify that and duplicate it and spread it all across America?
You wrote an article in the Huffington Post not too long ago that obviously I read. And you said, I don't understand trade deficits or debt ceilings or any of that stuff. I mean, I'm just a rapper. But I guess that's the point, right? You don't have to understand all that to know what the deal is.
It is rocket science.
Yeah.
We need to put our money in rocket science. Geniuses are recession-proof, and geniuses make technology and innovate. I would think that is our debt ceiling plan. What did you think that? I don't know.
I would think so. So here's the thing. I mean, you're the guy who did the Yes We Can video during the Obama campaign. It was remarkably successful. Obviously, you've got your music career. What's your sense of obligation, though? I mean, where does this come from?
I made a career out of music and entertainment, and one day I looked under the hood at what our entertainment was running off of, and it was running off of technology. Yes, hum the songs, but that guitar that they strumming, that's technology too. And that trumpet that they blowing, that's technology too. But we don't know who invented the trumpet. We just know Miles Davis, right? That's the problem.
Tell me about this robotics championship. What was it like?
The whole building was, electrified. And without the concert, they would have been happy. They were just over the moon that there was entertainment there. And we were celebrating education. We were celebrating innovation. You know, and all the people that came out, thank you guys so much for lending your time to support and applaud and acknowledge these kids' discipline.
Will I? That's all.
Thank you.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note, the United States has a new poet laureate today. Philip Levine is his name. Born in Detroit, first job on an assembly line there. We had him on the program a couple of years ago, and I asked him to read one of my favorites. It's called What Work Is.
We stand in the rain in a long line, waiting at Ford Highland Park. For work. You know what work is. If you're old enough to read this, you know what work is, although you may not do it. Forget you. This is about waiting, shifting from one foot to another, feeling the light rain falling like mist into your hair, blurring your vision, until you think you see your own brother ahead of you, maybe 10 places. You rub your glasses with your fingers, and of course it's someone else's brother, narrower across the shoulders than yours, but with the same sad slouch, the grin that does not hide the stubbornness, the sad refusal to give in to rain, to the hours wasted waiting, to the knowledge that somewhere ahead a man is waiting who will say, "No, we're not hiring today," for any reason he wants. You love your brother. Now suddenly you can hardly stand the love flooding you for your brother, who's not beside you or behind or ahead, because he's home, trying to sleep off a miserable night shift at Cadillac, so he can get up before noon to study his German. Works 8 hours a night, so he can sing Wagner, the opera you hate most, the worst music ever invented. How long has it been since you told him you loved him? Held his wide shoulders, opened your eyes wide and said those words, and maybe kissed his cheek? You've never done something so simple, so obvious. Not because you're too young or too dumb. Not because you're jealous or even mean or incapable of crying in the presence of another man. No. Just because you don't know what work is.
Philip Levine, the new Poet Laureate of the United States, and his poem called What Work Is. And that's Marketplace from APM on this Wednesday. That's American Public Media. Today, the Dow plunged 519 points, 4 2/3%. The NASDAQ off 101 points, 4%. The S&P 500 down 51 points, 4.4%. Vahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Bradford Craig, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the program for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you back here tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.